You've heard the headlines. Get some perspective now with Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
Good morning, and for Bruce St. James, I'm Jeff Munn, and our top story this morning, the Suns made history last night.
The Lead, brought to you by Burge Ford, off the U.S. 60 and Mesa Drive.
Indeed, a historic night for the Suns, the first overall pick in the draft, and they go...
With the first pick in the 2018 NBA Draft, the Phoenix Suns select DeAndre Ayton.
Yes, big night indeed inside the arena last night, downtown Talking Stick. This is what it sounded like. And our guest, John Bloom, was there. Now, John, the Phoenix Suns broadcaster, breaking down everything. We appreciate you being here with us. I know you're a little tired.
Happy to be here. Are you kidding me? This is another good day for the Phoenix Suns. And, you know, I remember it was about a month ago I was sitting here.
Yeah.
We were talking about getting the number one pick, and now it's all come to fruition, and it's in the form of a very large individual who I think is going to make a significant impact.
The first thing I'd want to know, John, and you were obviously very close to it last night, was there ever a point where the Suns were thinking about trading that pick?
Didn't seem like it, Jeff. I think that they were pretty set on DeAndre Ayton, and listening to Ryan McDonough, the general manager, both after making the pick and then again this morning, it sounds like they were committed to this even before they got the number one pick, that they knew DeAndre Ayton was going to be the guy. And then they got the number one pick, and you saw the celebration when that happened because they knew who they wanted, and now they have him. And that's an exciting thing for the Phoenix Suns and for their fans, no doubt.
And it's an exciting thing for DeAndre as well. Here's a little bit of what he had to say last night.
It means a lot to me because, you know, the fans out there are amazing. They're the best fans in the world. And, you know, I really want to go to the Phoenix. I'm really happy to be a part of the Phoenix Suns now to really start a winning legacy with Devin Booker and Josh Jackson and all those other guys. And, you know, they're great. You know, we're a young team and we're ready. You know, I'm just happy to be a Phoenix Sun.
So what does it mean for the Suns moving forward to have a guy like DeAndre on the team?
Well, I think it means a lot, Pamela, because, you know, you can't teach 7'1", 260 pounds. You can't turn people into that size. And then at the same time, what he's already proven is that he can move around for being that big. It's one thing to get a big guy, but it's another thing to get a guy who can actually play in the league with the way the league is moving. It's almost a situation where everybody who plays basketball now needs to learn how to play like a little guy, needs to learn how to play and be able to handle the basketball, pass the basketball, move around defensively and switch to smaller guys and stay with smaller guys. This is the new age of professional basketball in our country. And so DeAndre Ayton fits that. He's a great fit from that standpoint. He's also a great fit from a standpoint of he's built like a grown man already. Even though he's only 19, he looks like a lot older if you get a chance to watch him and see just not only his size and stature, but also just how he looks and carries himself. So you want somebody now as the Phoenix Suns who can come in and participate and contribute right away. A lot of things with the NBA draft are about potential down the road. Take an 18-year-old, 19-year-old, take a flyer. Maybe he'll turn into a great player. Suns can't afford to wait around anymore. They can't. They needed guys who could come in and help this team win now, and that's what they did last night.
I know there's been concerns, John, and we're talking with Suns broadcaster John Bloom, about why do you go with a guy who's, in the minds of a lot of people, a center. You mentioned the fact that, yes, he can play different spots on the floor. He can pass. He can shoot from outside. But I also, in talking with people close to the NBA, I get this sense that right now the game is almost positionless because of the success of the Golden State Warriors. But you hear a lot of teams now starting to kind of murmur, well, we can't completely copy what Golden State does, so we have to do something different. I think the NBA, 3 or 4 years from now, when he really starts to come into his own, may be a league that goes back to emphasizing the big man.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Jeff, because when you look around the league, a lot of the good young stars, the up-and-coming players, are around 7 feet. And they're in that same ilk as DeAndre Ayton, guys that can do multiple things, can affect the game on both sides. Offensively, look, I don't have to teach anybody about this. The rim is 10 feet off the ground. If you're a 7-footer, you're closer to the rim. The shot's easier to make.
Yeah. Right.
Also, your hand reaches up higher, and it's easier to affect other people's shots. So that's why I think size is always going to make a difference in the NBA. I don't think I'm saying anything that is way out on a limb here. I think if you've got a big guy who is flexible, who can maneuver, who isn't just stuck in the mud, which, you know, back in the day, maybe there were more guys like that who were up close to 7 foot, but just weren't the athletes. Now you can't afford to put a guy in there because you'll get beat on both sides. DeAndre Ayton's not one of those guys.
But we're talking to John. Go ahead.
I was just going to follow up real quick and say, rebounding is still a premium in basketball. At the NBA level, at any level, and you talk to the coaches every night after games, the first thing I'm almost certain they point to a lot of nights is how well did we rebound. And so that ties into you got to have a big man.
Totally, because again, he's closer to the basket, and he's also athletic, and he's really aggressive on the glass, which is something, it's almost like an innate ability. When you see a good rebounder, they want to be a good rebounder, and it seems like DeAndre Ayton's one of those guys. He wants to go up and rip that basketball off the glass, turn it the other way, and help his team get a bucket.
Talking to Suns broadcaster here, John Bloom, about the draft last night, but you know, DeAndre Ayton wasn't the only thing that the Suns did. They also had, you know, two other picks. Talk to us a little bit about some of the other decisions that they made.
Well, I think going into it, Pamela, a lot of us who know this team's makeup, there's so many young guys already on this team, you were thinking, they have four draft picks. There's no way they're picking four guys. They're not going to bring four more young guys onto this team. But that's what they did last night. And it's interesting the way it all transpired, because I was sitting there and we were thinking one thing, and then all of a sudden we had to think something completely different, because they made that trade to move up from number 16 to number 10. After the picks had already been made. So we knew the 10th pick in the draft was Mikal Bridges. And if you watch college basketball, you're probably familiar with his work. He won two championships in the last 3 years with the Villanova Wildcats and was a major reason for that. He's a fantastic talent. He's a guy who can play defense, actually enjoys playing defense, and then can shoot the three as good as pretty much anybody who came out in the draft last night. So I think this is a big-time pick for the Suns. And what I like about him, too, is he's not a kid. He's about to turn 22 years old, which sometimes people, when you look at the draft, you stay away from those guys because you want to take that chance at a guy who's 18 who's going to blossom into something completely different. We don't need Mikal Bridges to blossom into something completely different. He's already ready to go and play in the NBA. I think that's an exciting thing for the Suns. Then they added a point guard from France who I don't know a ton about other than the fact that he scored 44 points in a playoff game a couple weeks ago in France and came out of nowhere and kind of jumped up the lists of the experts. And so to get him at 31 is pretty good. And then the last guy they got is a guy that may or may not make the team from Colorado and George King, but another guy who plays defense and shoots. So I think they gave themselves some flexibility. That's what they were hoping for going in. And it's going to be a heck of a lot of fun to watch these kids play in Las Vegas in a couple weeks in Summer League.
Well, and the other thing, and to go kind of big picture on it, almost from the moment that the Suns won the draft lottery and the response of the fans that night, you heard the name DeAndre Ayton. You should never in sports go with exactly what the fans want to do. There's an old baseball term that says if you start making decisions the way the fans want you to, you'll end up sitting with them. And it's but in this case, I really think the Suns got an obvious benefit by doing what the public wanted them to do.
I agree, and I think that really when it came down to it, Ryan McDonough had very little choice. I think he had to go with DeAndre Ayton. You know, he's in a position right now this is his sixth season as the general manager. He hasn't made the playoffs yet, and you don't know how long that leash is going to be. That's another reason why right now maybe one of the biggest conversations over on the sports side is, did they give up too much to move up to get Mikal Bridges at number 10? They gave up an unprotected first-round draft pick in 2021 that they got in a trade with to send Goran Dragic to the Miami Heat years ago. Well, that's still 3 years away. Ryan McDonough doesn't have time to wait on that pick. He's got to make a move now. That's why I was pretty convinced he was going to do something like that, use some of the assets that he's already accumulated. He did. We'll see how it plays out now.
John Bloom, Suns broadcaster, again last night. If you missed it, it's what it sounded like inside Talking Stick Arena when the Suns picked DeAndre Ayton for the team. John, thanks so much. You know what, folks? We're also going to be talking to Al McCoy coming up at 10:30. You're not going to want to miss his thoughts on the draft last night. Again, that's coming up at 10:30. But next, we're going to give you the very latest on the immigration debate happening in this country. And while I'm not a big fan about talking about what other women are wearing, you just can't get away from Melania's jacket.
Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
Yeah, quick programming note for you. I've got Jeff Munn joining me today in house for Bruce St. James. So, welcome, Jeff.
Thank you, Pamela. Good to be here.
We also have the president, who is expected to speak around 11:30 today on immigration. We will be carrying that live for you right here on KTAR because, Jeff, there's been a lot that has been happening, not just this week, but within the last 24 hours on this really important issue. The latest being that the House is not going to be voting on what is considered the compromise immigration bill until next week. You've got the president tweeting this morning to hold off on that until November. You also have some reunifications happening with some of those kids who've been separated from their parents. But yesterday, right around this time, Jeff, Bruce and I looked up at the screens in front of us, and we saw something that we weren't anticipating, and that was First Lady Melania Trump sitting in a Texas detention center talking to kids. We didn't know that was coming. Nobody told us. And so I was so encouraged to see her there. And then after the show, I started seeing pictures of her jacket.
Yeah, and something that was written on the back of the jacket that says, "I really don't care, do you?" Which this opens up a whole lot of avenues we can discuss. Number one among them is what is Melania Trump doing wearing a jacket with some kind of message on the back? And was it a message? Was she sending the message? Was somebody else sending the message? And she just happened to be the messenger. And I was reading Chris Saliz's comments on CNN, and he made mention of the fact that, look, we're not just doing this because it's Melania Trump. If Michelle Obama had been walking around with a jacket that said, "I really don't care, do you?" we would be just as interested reporting on it the same way.
The First Lady wore that jacket saying, "I don't really care, do you?" Her spokesperson said there was no message intended, no hidden meaning. I mean, it wasn't hidden. It was written in huge print on the back of her jacket, unclear exactly who she was sending that message to, but it was one of the more bizarre fashion statements I think that we have ever seen from a First Lady.
Yeah, you know what? As we got off the air and I saw the image, in all reality, I thought it was a Photoshopped image and I didn't pay much attention to it. And then as I was doing some show prep after the show, I started digging in and super producer CVZ says, "Hey, did you see this jacket?" And I'm like, "That wasn't real." And then I looked at it, I'm like, whoa, wait, it was. And I even grabbed Chad Benson, who hosts the program here on KTAR in the evenings, and we started talking about it. And here's the thing, folks. There's a message. I'm not going to purport to know what that message is.
I'm not sure who, if anybody does. The president says he does.
But there's a message. Melania Trump is a model. Melania Trump knows fashion. Melania Trump wears expensive clothes. This jacket is a $40 Zara jacket.
Yeah.
And she put it on as she was leaving Texas, and it was so all the media could see it. And here's the deal. There's a message. What it is, I'm not exactly sure. But Jeff, I really liked the fact that First Lady Melania Trump went to Texas yesterday.
So do I.
I like the fact that, you know, she's an immigrant. She knows about this, and not necessarily the separation of families per se, but she's got a little bit of a different perspective than, say, you or I.
Right.
The fact that she hopped on a jet, said, "I'm going," and showed up, I thought was fantastic. I was sad that this choice of a jacket overshadowed the good that she did down there.
And she's already been out front as being in opposition to the separation of families, which at the time she made the comment ran counter to what the president had been saying up to that point. So you could tell that this was a sensitive topic with her. And you're right. It overshadows something. She's done quite a few things as First Lady that you say, gee, that's really good. And she's done really good work in certain areas. But the fact that she's very closed off, she doesn't speak to the media very much, she doesn't appear to be comfortable around the media, and then coupled with this, wearing this jacket with a message, it's almost as if we'd be a little bit more settled with it if we knew what the message was.
Yeah, you know what? And folks are out there speculating that because she's uncomfortable with the media, because of some of the coverage of her family and some of the news this week, you know, where her son has kind of been under attack, that this was, in fact, a message to the media. And it very well may have been. But for her office to come out and say, "It's a jacket, there's no hidden message, focus on what she did in Texas," I'd like to focus on what she did in Texas because I thought it was awesome that she went down
yeah.
there. But it's hard to do when you have this on your back. So, you know, I think that there are like three scenarios with her staff, and we know she has a smaller staff. Either nobody saw it and nobody said anything about it. That's scenario number one. Scenario, which I'm not going to buy, but I'll throw it out there.
I'm going to be honest
with like the three potential scenarios.
Yeah.
Scenario number two, they saw it and were afraid to say something.
That's likely.
Scenario number three, they saw it. They said, don't do it. Not a good look for what you're accomplishing down here. And she did it anyway.
I'd be more inclined to go with scenario two, because I think one thing that we've come to realize about the Trump White House is it's an atmosphere of intimidation. I mean, if you don't fall completely in line with what President Trump and to a certain extent the First Lady wants to do, you're not there very long. So would I go with scenario two? Yeah, they probably looked at it, said that's not a great idea, but probably didn't say anything to her.
Yeah, you know, I'm not big on just picking apart what people wear, unless it's like the Oscars or something. And you're like, ooh, I really like that dress.
Yeah.
I mean, my style, I'm wearing like a black T-shirt today. Like, I'm not a fashionista by any way, shape, or form. Who am I to judge what somebody else wears? But when you are the First Lady of the United States, messages like this, they have meaning. And if you don't provide that meaning, people will make it up for you. What do you think the jacket meant for Melania Trump? 602-200-2733. It's our open mic line. It's open 24-7. We give you 24 seconds to sound off. 602-200-2733. That open mic line is brought to you by Carol Royce with Keller Williams Realty East Valley. Listen, the jacket isn't the only thing going on with immigration. We are well aware of that. We're going to talk about the reunification of families with a guest next. And is the administration doing all they can to put those families back together? And just how hard is that? We're talking about it next here on KTAR News.
KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
Hey, coming up at 11:30, we have the president who's going to be talking about immigration, and we will be carrying that live for you right here on KTAR. But right now, we want to go to our KTAR newsmaker line and welcome Michelle Brane to the program. She is director of the Migrant Rights and Justice Program at the Women's Refugee Commission. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning.
I want to get your reaction to a tweet that the president sent out earlier this morning. Here is CNN reading that tweet.
He wrote this, quote, "We must maintain a strong southern border. We cannot allow our country to be overrun by illegal immigrants as the Democrats tell their phony stories of sadness and grief, hoping it will help them in the elections. Obama and others had the same pictures and did nothing about it."
Are the stories that we're seeing down along the border phony stories of grief?
Absolutely not. I can tell you personally, I've been there. I've seen them in person. And what I observed were very real. And really tragic and horrific scenes of what our government is doing.
Is there, Michelle, is there really a plan that we know of that at some point that the government will help reunite these families in some way? Because it doesn't seem very coordinated or very organized. Well, it's not organized at all, it seems.
No, there's nothing organized about this. They had no plan for how to separate or how to follow up on these separations. And currently, we have heard nothing about a plan on how to reunify. And in fact, advocates and attorneys and parents have desperately been trying to figure out how to reunify. And it's really being done on a very ad hoc, individual basis. So there's no plan whatsoever.
Well, we have the U.S. Customs and Border Protection that released a statement earlier this morning saying that some 500 kids of this 2,300 that have been separated from their families, some 500 of them have been reunited with their families. Your reaction to that, I mean, because it seems as though there isn't really a process to verify that. And that's, I hope it happened. Believe me, I hope it happened. But how do we know that these families are, in fact, being reunified?
Well, it's a really good question. I mean, I, of course, am also really hoping that that is happening and that it continues to happen, right? But since the government did nothing to keep track of the families that they separated and has not been transparent about any information they do have about these families, it's really hard to know. Again, we all hope that they are doing something to reunify and the parents do find their way back to their children. But there are still a couple thousand at least children who need to be reunified.
Michelle Brunet is the director of the Women's Refugee Commission Migrant Rights and Justice Program, and she joins us this morning on KTAR News 92.3. There is a quote given to NBC News that there's the possibility that you could be creating thousands of immigrant orphans in the U.S. that one day could become eligible for citizenship when they're adopted. But let me go back to the first part of that statement. I think it's a very real possibility that you could end up with kids not being reconnected with their families, and they do become orphans, which to me is the ultimate tragedy.
I mean, absolutely. These kids have parents. The United States has taken them away from their parents and ultimately has the responsibility of finding them again. So I don't think that we should in any way be willing to accept any sort of outcome in which they don't find their parents. That would be completely unacceptable and criminal in my mind.
So we've got this executive order that the president signed earlier this week and said that the families will no longer, you know, be separated and they're going to be working to reunify them. But how do you reunify a child that has been taken from their parent? Their parent is currently going through the criminal system, being prosecuted. You can't reunify a child with a parent who is being prosecuted, correct?
Well, it is complicated, but it's not impossible. And I think that's one of the big myths that the administration has put out, that their only options are to detain or just, you know, let people go and be weak, as the president says. That is just not true. There are programs in place all over the place that are used in the criminal system, but also in our immigration system, in which people are released into the community while they, you know, go through their court proceedings. People are not, I mean, the crime that they're being prosecuted for is a misdemeanor. That's like a jaywalking or speeding. We don't send people to jail while they defend themselves against these kinds of misdemeanors. So there are what they call a family case management program or alternatives to detention programs where people are in the community and have to show up for appointments or court hearings. There are programs within immigration that have been 99% effective in making sure people show up for all of their appointments and hearings.
I want to talk about
the administration is ignoring them.
I want to talk a little bit about that, Michelle. And if you're just joining us, we're talking to Michelle Brunet, director of the Migrant Rights and Justice Program at the Women's Refugee Commission. That's one of the statistics that I have been scouring, trying to find, because to me, the idea that you only have two options, one, you arrest everybody and separate families, or two, catch and release and hope they show up for court hearings. I want to know what percentage of individuals who are caught and released, I mean, that's the terminology people use, actually do show back up for their hearing.
So this is the really crazy part. The administration, immigration, does not keep that statistic in any way that is actually that actually makes sense. Because what happens is some people don't show up for court hearings, but that doesn't, or don't show up for deportation. That in some cases means that they won their case and got another way to stay here legally. They haven't actually meshed together the numbers in the right way. The other problem is that it's true. If people are released with no information whatsoever about what they're supposed to do, which has happened at some moments in our history, that is problematic, because if people don't even know what they're supposed to do to go to court, they're not going to show up. And of course, that's not what any of us want. But as I said, the programs in which people are actually put into a program that gives them this information and has them check in periodically have been incredibly successful. And the one that I'm talking about, family case management, 99% success, 99.8 in my calculations. And in fact, the Office of the Inspector General of Homeland Security, you can look on their website, found it to be 100% successful.
Michelle Brunet, Director of Migrant Rights and Justice Program at the Women's Refugee Commission, thank you so much for joining us and giving us some perspective on this. And Jeff, like, it makes me feel good that, like, I'm not the only one that couldn't find the number, because the number doesn't really exist.
And if they don't have the statistics, that almost destroys the argument for, well, we have to detain. We can't do catch and release. Why not? You don't even know how effective catch and release is.
Right. Man, so many questions here. All right. Hey, we're going to stay on top of the story. Again, we've got the president who's going to be speaking at 11:30. You're going to be able to hear that live here on KTAR, talking about immigration. But next, we're talking about education, because the Arizona School Board is thinking about punishing teachers. Yeah, the ones that actually participated in the walkout, the Red for Ed movement, We're going to dive into that story coming up next here on KTAR News.
Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes. KTAR News on 92.3 FM.
Oh, yes, parents, you remember this. The walkout, the teacher walkout in late April that led some 850,000 Arizona public school students without a place to go. More than 1,000 schools across the state shut down during the Red for Ed walkout. With the height of it, with 50,000 teachers and supporters descending on going to the state capitol and protesting for more teacher pay. Jeff Munden with me here today for Bruce St. James. And Jeff, that was a momentous occasion in the state of Arizona. And now we have the Arizona State Board of Education exploring the possibility as to whether they have any legal authority to punish those teachers.
And I assume that they're examining this to prevent anything like this from happening again in the future, although you would think that the move that Governor Ducey made to implement the 20% pay increase would probably take care of that for a while. I know that State Superintendent of Public Instruction, Diane Douglas, has said in the past that that she is deeply concerned about what these teachers were up to. We were talking before the show today. Mm-hmm. The state superintendent of public instruction at some point in the process has to be pro-teacher, has to be a teacher advocate. I've got your back. I know all about the law. But Diane Douglas, from the moment she's taken office, has seemed to be kind of an antagonist to teachers.
Yeah, and she was mostly quiet leading up to this protest. You know, we were trying to get her on the show. No one could find her. She wasn't willing to speak out
right until
just mere days before the teachers were going to strike. This was something that was building for quite some time, and she remained quiet. But right before the strike was about to happen, I'll give her credit where credit is due, she came into studio, she sat down with Bruce and I, and she talked about not wanting those teachers to strike. Let's play you a little bit from that interview late April.
I want teachers to be aware of the consequences and possible implications of this action, because I've been very loud and vocal telling them, please do not strike.
Okay, so what could some of those implications and consequences be?
I'm only going to tell them the truth and what is on the table for them. It is illegal to strike in Arizona, and by every definition I've read, this is a strike.
Okay.
To resign your position, and one can arguably say walking out on a strike could be resigning your position under the law, that is an actionable, unprofessional action on the part of a teacher. So that can be, and we deal with these all the time at the State Board, anything from a letter of censure to a suspension to a revocation. That's not my decision to make. The State Board makes that decision.
Now, she said in that cut right there, everything that I've read says what they did was a strike. I have to admit, as a layman, I never looked at it while it was going on as they were striking. I interpreted it as a protest movement. It didn't seem like a strike because they weren't going, they were just making a statement. And I understand the whole thing about intent or spirit of the law, letter of the law. But to me, I really think you're starting to really split hairs if you're going to call what Red for Ed was, if you're going to call it a strike.
You and I were different on this one. I think it was a strike. You don't show up to work and you shut down a school because you want more pay. It's a strike.
Okay.
Now, I don't have a problem with them striking. You know, this was one of the issues, Jeff, that I could argue both sides of. I saw both sides of this issue. But I think that the State Board of Education on Monday at their meeting, 9 a.m., if you want to show up, I think it sends a really bad message to the educators we have in this state. And here's why. We know that there is a teacher shortage in the state of Arizona.
Yes.
We know that some of our best and brightest are leaving to get pay increases in neighboring states like California or New Mexico.
All those
ads
for Fort Worth.
There are billboards up and around our very city trying to poach our best and brightest. Does the State Board of Education, exploring the idea of punishing those educators, How do you think they feel? Do you think they feel empowered? Do you think they feel valued? Do you think they feel respected?
No.
By the governing body of their industry?
No, and that's what a lot of this has been about as well. It hasn't been just about a pay increase. A lot of those teachers felt disrespected, undervalued, way before Red for Ed, and that was as much what that protest slash strike was about as it was just getting a pay raise. And so you get the pay raise. It's going to take a little while for it to fully implement. But now, months later, now you're right back to basically point A, saying to yourself, we're not respected by the people that hire us.
Right. So we got this Arizona State Board of Education meeting. It's going to be taking place Monday, 9 a.m. And the board is looking to get some legal guidance, all right, to find out if there's anything they can or should be doing, from censoring teachers all the way up from removing teacher certificates. Now, I don't think anybody's going to lose a teaching certificate over this. I honestly don't. Hence, let's go back to the teacher shortage aspect of all of this. But it's going to be something that we're going to be watching. And if you think teachers should be punished or let it go, we want to hear from you on the open mic line. 602-200-2733. Well, we got the president that's going to be speaking about 11:30. We're going to carry it live for you here on KTAR. But can the president's zero tolerance policy coexist with not separating families down at the border? We're going to ask the former head of U.S. Customs and Border Protection for his perspective on that. You're not going to want to miss it. It's coming up next here on KTAR News.